a gangly man with a wispy mouse-brown comb-over. He placed a covered, clear plastic bin the size of a shoebox on the table. Inside, a live frog hunkered, looking lonely and pitiful. He called the class to order and held up an instrument with a wooden handle and a metal pointy end, like a mini ice pick.
"This probe," he said as if announcing an Oscar winner, "will be used as a pith tool."
I sucked in a breath.
"You're going to kill that poor little frog?"
I blurted, aghast. His lips separated to show teeth in a god-awful abortion of a smile.
"First off, you will pith your frog. Second, if you double-pith the frog exactly as I instruct, you will destroy the brain and spinal cord. The creature will be mindless and pain-free, but very much functionally alive. Third," he said before I could point out how much worse that was, "I'm not going to make you do anything."
His mouth widened.
"However, anyone who does not follow the proper procedures, which happen to include pithing your frog, will simply receive a grade of 0 for this lab."
Groans and mutters rippled through the class. A curly-headed guy I didn't know raised his hand.
"Are we all going to dissect that one frog?"
A whisper of existential ennui flashed over the professor's face.
"No, Mr. Jenkins," he said through his teeth. "The rest of the frogs are in a tank in the supply room at the end of the hall. After I lecture, we will all walk down there and I will—"
"Yes, Miss Sanders."
A girl nearly as scrawny as me lowered her hand.
"Why do we have to learn about frog guts anyway? It's so stupid."
"Comparative anatomy, Miss Sanders," he bit out, "though I don't expect you'll take much away from the exercise."
I hid a scowl. If the dude wasn't such a tool, I might almost feel sorry for him for having to deal with students who either didn't appreciate or didn't really want an education. But anything a bunch of newbie biology students could learn from a pithed frog could just as easily be learned from frogs pre-killed and nicely packed in formalin. And yeah, they'd end up dead either way, but there was no way this group would get the pithing right on the first try. And the gleam in Dingle's eyes told me he wanted us to pith the fucking frogs ourselves because he was an asshole. Asshole. But mostly, I didn't want to kill a frog. Sure, I'd killed humans when they were trying to kill or hurt me or my friends. Even when it was justified, it still sucked. Besides, the frogs weren't trying to kill me.
"Miss Romero?"
Dingle snapped.
Isabella fumbled her phone and it crashed to the floor.
"Yes, sir?"
"Some of us are trying to learn."
He whacked his workbench with the flat of his hand. The poor frog flinched.
"Phone. Here. Now."
"But my kid's sick. I was just check—"
"Now, Romero."
I fisted my hands to keep from flipping Dingle off as Isabella slunk to the front and deposited the phone. Dingle the dick got off on embarrassing people. He'd tried that crap with me once, but this small-minded asshole couldn't touch me. I'd been through hell and back. After she returned to her seat, Dingle droned on about the differences and similarities between human and frog internal anatomy. I felt safe enough tuning out since I'd seen more human organs than this guy ever would. Much more important was the issue of the frogs. If anyone could liberate them, it was me. My gaze went to the door. The science building had been built in the 50s and never been modernized, which meant there were still transoms for ventilation. The plan came together in my head. I shot my hand up. Dingle glared at me.
"What is it, Miss Crawford?"
"I need to use the restroom."
"You should have taken care of that before class."
It's a female problem. His eyes narrowed a little while I put on a desperate and horrified expression. But since I was undeniably female, he could hardly insist I was lying.
Go.
As he snarled the word, I activated a dose of combat mod. It slammed through me, charging every cell with hyperpotential. The hardest part was walking at a normal hurry speed to the door while the modified and concentrated parasite stimulant coursed through my body. But the instant I closed the door behind me and made sure no one was in the hall, I used every fucking molecule of that mod. I sprinted to the end of the corridor, breaking every Olympic record for the next 20 years. At the supply room door, I jumped and caught the top of the jam, then did a one-arm pull-up and held myself there while I propped the transom open with my other hand. With the ease of breathing, I pulled myself up and through the transom, twisting in midair to land in a crouch. I was winning all the Olympic medals. I'd been in here before, so I knew there were several 5-gallon buckets in the corner. At super speed, I grabbed one, uncovered the tank, scooped frogs and water, placed the lid on loosely, opened the door, and set the bucket against the wall outside, closed and locked the window, all in the span of about 15 seconds. Getting out was simple. Jump up, make sure the coast is clear, dive through, twist, and land. Another one-arm pull-up to close the transom, then sprint like hell back. I stopped before the lab door and slowed my breathing, ran my hands over my hair to smooth any scraggly bits, then walked in, nice and calm-like. Dingle broke off mid-word and narrowed his eyes at me. My pulse quickened in response. Did I have frog goo on me somewhere? Had he heard me running?
That didn't take very long, he said. I thought you were having female troubles.
False alarm, I said with a cheery shrug. You know how it is. You feel a bit squishy, and you're not sure if it's just crotch sweat or...
I do not require an explanation, he gritted out.
Someone tittered, and his scowl deepened.
If we are quite finished learning about Angel Crawford's reproductive system, perhaps we can commence the lab portion of this class. Everyone, follow me.
I summoned a placid expression and dutifully marched after him to the storage room. Dingle pulled a set of keys from a pocket, unlocked the deadbolt, and marched into the room.
You will enter one at a time and take an empty container from the shelf, he announced. I will place your frog in your container, and then the next student.
He trailed off as he came into view of the tank and its distinct lack of frogs.
What the fuck?
He whirled, scanning the room as if hoping they'd taken up residence elsewhere.
This is impossible. I checked the tank right before class.
His mouth tightened.
Crawford, did you do something to the frogs?
I widened my eyes in shocked innocence, but the rest of the class leaped to my defense.
She was only gone a minute,
curly-headed guy said. The door was locked, another student pointed out. Dingle slowly turned.
The transom. You could have climbed in over the transom.
I scoffed. Do you see how short I am?
She's right, Prof,
a guy said who was at least a foot taller than me.
And even if she could jump that high, she doesn't have the muscle tone to haul herself up.
Thanks. Dingle moved to the window and checked the lock. I watched, tense. If he got close to the glass and looked down, he'd see the bucket. But Dingle apparently decided the intruder would have a hard time locking the window behind him, and the bushes out there were deterrent enough. He stepped away from the window, subdued, dejected even. If he wasn't such a flaming turd blossom, I wouldn't have been forced to ruin his day.
Very well,
he said, all trace of arrogance gone.
We shall return to the lab and,
he sighed,
do a virtual dissection online.
As we filed toward the lab, curly-headed guy leaned close.
I don't know how the hell you did it, but I owe you a beer.
I masked a grin, but an instant later my breath caught. I'd forgotten all about the frog on the front table. I needed to find a way to save him, too. Knowing Dingle, he'd take his frustration out on the poor thing. Unfortunately, the only rescue plan I could think of involved liquid nitrogen and a tub of peanut butter. Not terribly feasible. We shuffled into the room, and I cast a forlorn glance at the container on the front workbench. The empty container. Still covered. Hot diggity damn. Someone else in the class had risen to the challenge. Dingle entered last, then stopped dead as he registered the frog's absence. His shoulders sagged.
You have 5 minutes to go over your notes,
he muttered.
I need a moment.
He turned and slumped out of the room. I bit my lip against a laugh and sent silent thanks to the unknown hero who'd rescued the last little froggy. Chapter 12. After the class finally let out, I dawdled outside the building, pretending to be on my phone as I made sure Dingle was indeed headed to his office in the next building over. I carefully checked my surroundings for possible witnesses, pausing as I caught sight of Isabella striding briskly toward the parking lot. When she reached the sidewalk, she stopped and set her bag down, then crouched and peeked into her lunchbox. Apparently satisfied with what she saw, she closed it, stuffed it into her bag, and hurried off. Oh, Isabella, you sneaky little minx, I murmured with a mixture of delight and admiration. If that wasn't a frog in her lunchbox, I'd eat my backpack. With that particular mystery solved, I slipped behind the bushes and retrieved the bucket of frogs with, crossing fingers, no one the wiser. Getting them to my car was a bit more challenging, especially since the only available parking had been somewhere near the rings of Saturn. Halfway there, I had to stop and secure the lid after nearly sloshing a frog out. But the gods must have been smiling upon me, because no one seemed to notice or care that I was lugging a heavy bucket across the parking lot. Arms aching, I eventually reached my car and jammed the bucket behind the passenger seat. Securely enough, I hoped that it wouldn't tip over and turn my car into a traveling pond. Of course, then I was worried about them suffocating with the lid closed. After all, there were a lot of frogs in there. I solved the problem by digging a pocket knife out of my console and cutting a fist-sized hole in the lid. There. Frogs could breathe, and sloshing water and frogs would still be contained. Whistling Rainbow Connection, I got the hell out of there. Though I'd never performed a heroic frog rescue before, I knew the very best place to give them their freedom. A few months ago, I had picked up a body at Bell Mason Estates, about 10 miles north of Tucker Point. On my way out of the subdivision, I got lost and ended up driving around the prettiest pond I'd ever seen. The frogs would love it. With nearly an hour before I had to be at work, I might even have a bit of chill-out me time after I liberated the captives. Bell Mason Estates was a gated community, but like darn near every other gated community I'd been to, the gates stood open during the day. Made me wonder what the point was. Did they think bad people only came out at night? Plus, did they realize how laughingly easy it was to get in, even with the gates closed? All you had to do was follow another car in. I snickered as I sailed through the impressive, open, and pointless gates. Security theater. Make things look safer and more secure without actually being so. Other than the silliness with the gates, there was a lot to like about the place. I made my way down peaceful winding roads, past lovely large houses on lovely large lots. Walking trails wound throughout the neighborhood, and there were trees everywhere. It was obvious you had to have a lot of money to live here, but it wasn't obnoxious and in-your-face about it. Classy. Like a genteel southern lady. After several turns, I took a road that circled the pond and rejoined itself like the eye of a needle. About a third of the way around, I parked in a space nestled in a grove of flowering trees, then unloaded the bucket, relieved to see that only a little water had splashed out.
I followed a path through the grove and to the water's edge. The pond was sort of a squished oval shape, measuring about 100 yards at its longest point. Wildflowers bloomed along the banks amidst reeds and cattails. Turtles sunned themselves on a partially submerged log, and butterflies flitted everywhere. A shaded walking trail offered exercise with a lovely view, and every 30 or 40 yards a wrought iron bench rested beneath mature oaks. It was gorgeous. I seriously needed to get rich so I could live here. A woman with sleek salt and pepper hair caught up in a tidy bun strolled down the trail toward me. A shaggy, mixed-breed dog padded by her side, tongue lolling. She waved.
Hello there.
Crap. Suddenly the bucket felt very conspicuous. I hadn't planned what to say if asked why I was dumping frogs in the pond. Hiya, I replied with a bright smile. Nice day, huh? She approached and peered into my bucket. The big dog sat without command, ears perked.
Parish project, I blurted. Repopulating local habitats.
I wasn't aware local frogs were on the decline, she said,
accent smooth and Midwestern.
She tilted her head, amusement dancing in her eyes. I scrambled to come up with my next line, but there was something disarming about this woman. You know I'm lying through my teeth. She laughed.
You have a passel of Ranapipians, all the same size, so probably raised in captivity, in a bucket stenciled TPCC, not St. Edward's Parish.
Oh, crap. I squinted at the frogs, then at her. Wait, you know what species of frog they are?
Only because it's the most common one used in labs, she chuckled. And I have a PhD in conservation biology with a specialty in riparian environments.
Well, I could not be any more busted, I said ruefully. Our jerk of a professor wanted us to pith these guys, I made a face. It just didn't seem right to let them be killed by a bunch of students who don't give a rat's ass about learning. And what does riparian mean?
The area between land and a river, stream, or bayou, she said without the slightest hint of condescension. The banks, to put it simply. Her smile warmed. In other words, I completely support your rescue of these frogs. Besides, with all the new video tech, there's no need for undergrads to work on live animals. Some states don't allow it.
She grabbed the bucket handle with me.
We'd better be quick before someone from the Homeowners Association comes through. They'll raise a ruckus over your little relocation project.
Together, we lugged the bucket to the edge and scooped frogs into the water. They swam quickly away, leaving only ripples behind. Bye-bye, froggies. I gave them a cheery wave, stupidly pleased at the success of my scheme. I had no delusions about what would happen to them now. Some would end up as dinner for various wildlife. Others might meet their maker beneath a car tire or get sick and die from some dread froggy disease. As if reading my thoughts, the woman said,
Old Blue will likely spot some of them.
She nodded toward the far end of the pond where a stately heron stood motionless among the reeds. I shrugged. That sort of thing would happen wherever I took them. My hope is for a few of them to survive and go on to make happy froggy families. Either way, they're better off than if I'd left them in that storage room.
No argument from me.
I'm Angel Crawford. Now that we were partners in crime, it couldn't hurt to give her my name. Thanks for the help.
Portia Antilles, and this is Moose.
She nodded toward the dog. Nice to meet you both. I emptied the last of the water from the bucket.
You're a biologist? That's so cool.
I enjoyed my work tremendously, she said. I retired last fall.
I didn't think she looked old enough to retire, but then again, I wasn't the best judge of age. Besides, maybe she had a good retirement account. Nice place to retire.
Yes, it is.
Portia's gaze traveled over the pond before returning to me.
So, tell me, do you often pilfer amphibians?
I laughed. No more than the average biology student, but who knows what the future holds?
Good to leave your options open, she nodded in approval. How long have you been taking classes at TPCC?
This is my first semester, I said, then winced. I'm only taking two classes, though. I work full-time as a morgue tech at the coroner's office.
You must find that absolutely fascinating, she said, watching me with interest.
I do, I said, pleased she understood. It's really awesome.
I'm very glad to hear it. And don't fret about your course load. I didn't start college until I was 25.
Well, I dropped out of high school when I was 15 and just got my GED last year.
Portia cocked her head. Yet here you are.
I grinned. Yeah, here I am, an accomplished frog thief. She laughed, then dropped her eyes to Moose as he leaned against her leg.
My assistant here is reminding me I need to get home. It was very nice to meet you, Angel. I do hope our paths cross again someday.
It was nice to meet you too, I said, and ditto. Portia gave me a parting smile, then headed back the way she came, Moose trotting happily at her side. As I watched her leave, my gaze fell on a dark blue Tahoe cruising slowly around the pond. I went still, watching and ever so slightly wary. There were plenty of Tahoes just like the one Pierce drove, but not that were actually being driven by Pierce. Dark hair, powerful build, strong jaw. Yep, that was him in the driver's seat. Why on earth was he here? I grabbed the bucket and hurried up the path to the relative concealment of the trees. Once there, I crouched and watched as the vehicle rounded the far end of the loop. Was he following me? And if so, why? I couldn't think of a single reason that made sense. Not to mention, I'd been here for several minutes already, so either he'd been pretty far behind me, or he was being impatient and looking for me now, which really didn't make sense, since my car wasn't exactly concealed. My bafflement increased as Pierce pulled to the side of the road just shy of making the full loop. Definitely not in a position to be watching me. I suspected he had zero idea I was here. He had some other goal in mind. Wildly curious, I dashed to my car, stuffed the bucket into the trunk, then grabbed a pair of field glasses. As soon as I returned to my semi-concealed vantage in the trees, I trained the glasses on Pierce. I had a silly instant of worry that I'd see him looking straight at me through his own field glasses, but his attention appeared to be on a house up the street, the second one from the pond. My curiosity increased about 1,000,000,000%, and I scrutinized the house in question. It wasn't a mansion like some of the houses here, but it was definitely nice. 2-story, pale brick, with pretty landscaping full of flowers, and a half-circle driveway where a white Audi was parked.
Very interesting, I murmured.
Interesting and ever so slightly annoying. I needed to be at work in 20 minutes, and I had to drive past the house Pierce was watching to leave the neighborhood. He had paid no attention to my car in the little parking lot, but he'd certainly recognize it as mine as I went by. And even though we were each here on completely separate errands, I knew damn well he'd give me grief of some sort because Pierce. If I had to wait him out, I might as well be nosy. I took note of the address, then pulled up the property tax website on my phone and did a search. Owner, Pennington Jane Alexis.
Holy shit, I breathed.
Pierce was stalking his ex, or rather Pietro's ex, who was also known as Congresswoman Jane Pennington. She and Pietro had dated, but Pierce had told us no one was to inform her that he was Pietro. 0 exceptions, full stop. And clearly he hadn't spilled the beans to her, or he'd be knocking on the door instead of skulking around. I bit back on a laugh. Talk about unexpected. Pierce was always so serious and careful and focused, And here he was, clearly pining for his lost love. I glanced at my watch. He needed to pine a little faster, or I was going to be late to work. The minutes ticked by as Pierce watched the house. Right when I was about to say to hell with it and zoom past him, he lifted his phone. After a conversation that lasted maybe half a minute, he drove off. I checked my watch. Barring disaster, I'd make it to work with minutes to spare. Add that to freeing the frogs and meeting Portia, and this was turning out to be a damn fine day. Chapter 13. Alan called when I was less than a mile from the morgue.
As soon as you clock in, head out to Highway 1268 near the parish line. Traffic fatality. Nick's already on his way in his own car.
Gotcha. I held back a sigh that I'd be working with Nick again. Yes, please, let me have more tension in my life. But I couldn't really complain since Alan was great about scheduling my shifts around my classes. By the way, did the, exterminators ever come?
Wait, what? Did you see a roach?
No, I mean, bugs.
What kind of... Oh. Yeah, they came. No roaches.
You do know I'm talking about listening devices, right? Alan huffed.
Yes, Angel, I get it. No bugs.
After he hung up, I muttered a few choice curses. If the morgue wasn't bugged, then how the hell had Saberton known about the gators and the shambler? Baffled, I clocked in, snagged the van keys, then got on my way. Louisiana State Highway 1268 was a long two-lane stretch of nothing, giving me plenty of time to think about my life choices. Too bad it only took about 3 minutes for me to accept my choices as a lost cause, for now at least. With another 20 minutes left to kill, I started the audiobook of the essay collection I was supposed to read for my English class. Listening to my required reading not only made these long drives bearable, but since my reading speed was about as fast as a snail on Xanax, it also saved me hours and hours of time that could be better spent doing important stuff, like sleeping or watching funny videos online. Unfortunately, a legit and legal audio recording of the collection, which I'd have gladly paid for, didn't exist. Instead, I pirated a PDF copy, found a program that would read it to me, and also bought the paperback so I wouldn't feel guilty about the piracy. The robotic tones of the e-narrator droned on as I left what passed for civilization in St. Edward's Parish. After several miles of pine forest, I crossed an ancient drawbridge where rust-covered struts supported two counterweights that would lift the entire roadway to let boats pass. By some miracle, I made it to the other side without the bridge collapsing into brick-red dust. The pines gave way to water oaks and tallow trees, and wildflowers bloomed madly along the shoulders in a frenzy of gold and magenta and purple. I crossed yet another decrepit drawbridge, and the trees thinned, interspersed with low scrub and grass. A few miles farther, red and blue lights flashed just beyond a sharp curve. A helicopter rose from the highway and zoomed off, heavy thwop, 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 vibrating my van. As I neared the line of emergency vehicles, a fire and rescue ambulance drove away from the scene, lights dark. I exchanged waves with the driver, then did the same with the driver of the passing fire truck. Since I didn't know what I was dealing with yet, I left the gurney and body bag in the van and trekked up the highway past Nick's Hyundai and two sheriff's office cruisers. Up ahead, a gnarled oak tree hunkered 20 feet or so from the shoulder, bark gouged with old scars. 40 feet beyond the oak, a black Camaro rested upside down like a dead insect. Halfway between the tree and car, Nick stood beside a human-shaped lump in the grass, clipboard in hand. An odd sense of déjà vu tugged at me as I trudged toward him. There was something familiar about this area, but I couldn't put my finger on it for the life of me. Didn't help that I'd never been to this part of the highway. Then again, it was a desolate stretch of cracked pavement in the middle of nowhere,
and there were at least 1,000 similar settings in St. Edward's Parish. A rake-thin deputy, with a familiar sunburned face, rolled a measuring wheel down the center line. He stopped at a faint skid mark and wrote something in a pocket notebook, then gave me a chin lift and a smile.
Hey, Angel, are you stalking me?
Hey, Connor. If I was, you'd never know it. I gestured toward the wrecked car. Don't the state troopers handle accidents on state highways?
They do. But they're dealing with an overturned chicken truck west of Longville. The troop asked the sheriff's office if we'd work on it until someone can break free. Since I usually do the accident reconstruction for our jurisdiction, the captain had me come out.
I nodded sagely. Makes sense. Who's with you?
Blag.
Connor hooked a thumb behind him.
He's taking pictures at the other end.
It took me a second to realize he was referring to Blagojevic. How the hell do you pronounce his name? And I stopped and peered at the oily sheen covering his sunburn. What do you have all over your face? He chuckled.
I think it's Blagojevic, but my rule is I don't gotta learn any newbie's name until they've been here 6 months. And it's coconut oil.
He pointed at his face.
My mom swears by it for sunburns. Next time, though, I'm bringing my own damn sunscreen.
Could have been worse, I said, expression serious. You might have been wearing a Speedo out there.
Yeah, at least I only got sunburned bad on my face and neck.
No, I meant it would be worse for everyone else if you'd been wearing a Speedo. I danced back as Connor swung a mock punch at me.
Good thing you're cute, he growled.
Aw, I'd kiss you, but I'm afraid I'd slide right off, he winked.
You can owe me.
I blew him a kiss, then continued to where Nick crouched in the wildflowers. As I got closer, the lump resolved into the badly mangled body of a white male. Blood stained the ground, but not a big pool of it, most likely because his entire torso had been crushed, instantly stopping his heart.
Spencer Lee, 34 years old.
Nick tapped the driver's license on his clipboard. His jawline bore a shadow of purple from where Douglas Horton had clipped him. My gaze lingered on the bruise, then shifted away. Is he the only fatality?
So far.
His mouth thinned as he straightened.
The driver has multiple compound fractures and a tenuous airway. He's being airlifted to Baton Rouge, the closest Level 1 trauma center.
I took in the deep gouges in the turf. What happened? Nick sighed and lifted his chin toward the mangled vehicle.
Connor says it looks like the driver took the turn way too fast, overcorrected, and flipped 3 times. Neither occupant was wearing a seatbelt. The passenger here was ejected and crushed by the vehicle. Driver got bounced around inside.
He scowled as he looked down the road.
This is a bad curve. It's supposed to be marked, but an accident a couple of years ago took out the signs, and they've never been replaced.
He returned his attention to his notes.
That was a fatality, too.
My entire body went cold as if I'd been dunked in ice water. Glass and twisted metal, dark blood and jagged white bone, gray brains, and hunger. So much hunger. My heart began to pound. That oak? The curve? I knew this place. I knew it because I'd been here before, 1 year and 8 months ago.
I worked spit into a mouth gone dry.
That fatality was Herbert Singleton, I said, amazed I could keep my voice steady. He died the day before I started working at the morgue. You told me you'd autopsied 2, and neither one had a head.
Damn. I'd forgotten all about that.
Nick glanced up with a slight smile.
You have a really good memory.
His smile faded as he registered my stricken expression.
What's wrong?
I swallowed. That was the night I... His forehead puckered.
The night you what? Angel?
Nick? I took a shaking breath. I was in that car, with Herbert, Huh? How could you?
His eyes widened and he took a step back.
Oh, Jesus. The driver was decapitated. You... Did you... No, I didn't kill him. I wasn't a zombie then. And Herbert was already dead. That's what I was told.
I hugged my arms around myself and looked away from the horror in his eyes. I was fucked up bad that night, dying even before the crash. Herbert had roofied my drink, but didn't realize I was already high. I think when I started having trouble breathing, he came out here to dump my body. Nick didn't speak for several seconds. When he finally did, his voice was brittle.
He intended to rape you?
I let out a short, humorless laugh. That's usually the next step after you roofie someone. A shiver crawled down my spine. I don't remember most of that night. But I woke up in the emergency room without a scratch on me, and with a note saying I had a job waiting at the morgue. I dared a look at him, but his expression was unreadable.
Forgot you didn't know any of this, I sighed.
I mean, you found out the hard way what I am, but not how or why. Nick remained still and silent for several agonizing seconds. Then he glanced toward the highway as the sound of an approaching car reached us.
State police are here, he said,
tone betraying nothing of his thoughts.
You should be able to take the body in a few.
Right. I couldn't think of anything else to say, so I returned to the van and busied myself with getting the body bag unfolded just right. By the time the state trooper gave me the go-ahead to remove the body, I'd perfectly spread out the body bag, organized the loose change in the console, and regained my composure. Nick and I transferred Spencer Lee into the bag, then Trooper Huang helped us to carry it to the highway where the gurney waited. While Nick and Huang conferred, I wheeled the gurney to the van, teeth clenched as the cracked and pitted asphalt sent jangling vibrations through the stretcher. Blagojevich was on his phone in his cruiser. Connor glanced up from his notes as I drew close, then leaped to open the back of the van for me, though I didn't really need the assistance since it was designed to be pushed right into the van with the legs folding up neatly beneath it. But I had a feeling hefting a dead body for me was Connor's way of flirting. Thanks for the help, I said, then stifled a gasp at how pale he looked despite his sunburn. Dude, are you okay? Sweat covered his oily face. His throat worked as he swallowed.
Feel weird all of a sudden.
His hand trembled as he pressed it to his stomach.
Must have eaten something.
His eyes rolled up and his knees buckled. Shit! I dove forward barely in time to keep his head from smacking the pavement. A shudder passed through him and he began to convulse. Nick! I shrieked, then tore off my jacket and stuffed it under Connor's head. Blagojevich bailed out of his car.
Oh, fuck.
Ambulance left maybe 10 minutes ago, I gasped. See if you can get them back.
Got it.
He keyed up his radio, then barked stuff about Officer Down and paramedics. Connor jerked beneath my hands, face impossibly pale, with frothy spit oozing from the corner of his mouth. I rolled him to his left side into recovery position. Nick sprinted up, tugging on a fresh pair of gloves, and dropped to his knees beside Connor. Huang followed, speaking urgently on his cell phone.
What do we do?
I asked.
We keep him from hurting himself?
Nick said tersely, as he checked on Connor's pulse. Blagojevich lowered his radio.
ETA, 2 minutes on the ambulance. How the hell could they? Never mind.
Nick muttered.
Doesn't matter as long as they get here fast. Good job using the jacket to cushion his head, Angel. What happened?
He helped me get the gurney into the van, but all of a sudden looked pale and was sweating buckets. Then bam, he dropped. I shook my head. How can he be a cop if he has epilepsy?
I don't think he does, but that's not the only cause of seizures.
Nick exhaled as Connor stopped convulsing.
His pulse is slow, really slow.
Blagojevich shifted from foot to foot in consternation.
I spent all damn day with him yesterday, and the day before. He was fine.
Maybe it's from the sun, I said. Bad burn and more sun today?
Could be, Nick said. Get his shirt open and sleeve rolled up. Paramedics will probably want to start a line.
I didn't bother fumbling with buttons and simply ripped Connor's shirt wide open and the front of his ballistic vest off, revealing a fish belly pale chest. I tore his sleeve along the seam to his bicep and exposed a 4-inch square of gauze taped to his forearm. A tiny spot of blood stained one side where a scratch extended beyond the edge of the bandage. Cold dread filled my gut as I stared down at the tiny line of scabs.
No. There's no way.
I peeled the gauze up, heart pounding at the sight of 3 deep scratches trailing from a pair of ugly bruises. Nick glanced over and breathed a curse. How did he get this? I demanded, eyes on Blagojevich.
Huh? Oh, alligator?
He offered a strained smile.
It was the darndest thing. Connor was working a drag line, and out of nowhere, this fucking gator comes out of the water and goes for his arm. But my boy's got good reflexes and snatched his hand back before the fucker could bite down. Got grazed instead of chomped.
He's tough, I managed to say. Leaning close, I took a good sniff and picked up a whiff of the Douglas Horton Shambler smell, confirming my suspicion. Shit, shit, shit. This couldn't be happening. Judd and Douglas had both been dead and come back to Shambler life. Connor was most definitely alive. A whole new and awful pattern. The ambulance raced up and stopped with a squeal of tires. 2 paramedics leaped out, grabbed their monitor and jump bag, and ran to us. I backed away to give them room.
Good thing Barney wanted to stop and take pictures of that drawbridge, the driver said. Good thing Howard let me,
Barney replied, even as Connor let out a weird moan that lifted the hair on my arms. Whatever he has might be contagious. I wished I could come up with a way to say, and don't let him bite you, without sounding weird as hell. Barney simply gave me a nod and tugged on gloves. In under a minute, the paramedics had IV access and the cardiac monitor hooked up. Howard took a blood pressure, then manually checked Connor's pulse at the wrist and neck. He let out a low whistle.
Bradycardia. 24 beats per minute. VP 50 over palp. How's he even conscious?
Don't know,
Barney said.
But he is, so let's roll.
Without warning, Connor lunged and clawed at the paramedics, teeth clacking unnervingly, eyes wild and cloudy.
Shit, restraints!
Howard gritted out. It took all of us to wrestle the slavering Connor onto the stretcher and restrain him, and then both medics and Huang to get the stretcher loaded. Blagojevich strode toward his car, face filled with distress.
I'm going to follow them to the hospital.
I'll be there as soon as I can, I said. Keep me posted if anything changes, please.
Will do. Thanks, Angel.
The ambulance took off, lights flashing, with Blagojevich right behind them.
Fuck.
I yanked the van door open, then felt a hand on my arm. Nick's.
I just talked to Alan, he said. Take my car and go to the hospital. I'll take the van and check the body in.
He held the keys out for me. Thanks. I resisted the urge to throw my arms around him in a hug of gratitude. We exchanged keys. Then I paused as a stupid little worry leapt out. Who's going to drive Connor's unit?
Sheriff's office is sending someone out,
Nick said, voice gentle and reassuring. Huang has to stick around anyway until the tow truck comes for the Camaro. Okay. Right. I wanted to stay right there with Nick, worrying about little shit like minor logistics, things I could handle. But I couldn't. Not with the horking shitstorm stirred up by Connor's collapse. I quick-timed it to Nick's Hyundai. As soon as I was on the road, I called Dr. Nikas. We have a problem. Chapter 14. The call to Dr. Nikas didn't last long, since there wasn't much to tell. Connor collapsed,
and started acting shambly a day after being teeth grazed by a gator. A few minutes after I hung up, Dr. Nikas sent me a text, asking me to meet up with Alan at the hospital to obtain samples from Connor. No words of reassurance or hints at a simple explanation. Over a dozen cop cars lined the street near the emergency room, and I recognized another half dozen unmarked units in the parking lot. Connor was their brother in blue, and they were here for him. I found a spot for the Hyundai on the last row and hiked to the ER. The instant I walked through the waiting room door, worried deputies mobbed me for details of the accident scene events. I related the Chandler-free version, then had to repeat it for Connor's sergeant and lieutenant, then again for the chief deputy and the sheriff himself. With every retelling, the sick feeling in my gut grew. Was Connor even really alive and himself anymore? I clung to hope since he'd never died like both Judd and Douglas Horton. But if he was alive and mentally whole, what then? We had no cure for the normal zombie parasite, much less for a mutated version. I finally slipped away from the sheriff and found Alan scanning the crowd for me.
"This way,"
he said tightly. We ducked through the double doors that led to the treatment area. The noise level dropped away, the worried hum receding to background tension. "How'd you get access when everyone else is stuck out in the waiting room?" I asked.
"Connor's mom is on her way here from Longville."
He started down the corridor with long strides, and I trotted to keep up.
"I know her, and the ER doc's a friend. Between the two of them, I wrangled my way in."
"How's Connor doing?"
"Restrained. He almost bit a nurse who was trying to put in a catheter. A patient care assistant yanked her back in the nick of time."
I tensed. Did Connor get his teeth on her at all? If it was like his minor gator encounter, any break of the skin would do it.
"Not even close, thank God. That PCA was on the ball. I need to remember to tell his boss."
Alan opened a door to our right.
"In here."
I followed him into a treatment room where Connor writhed on the bed, wrists and ankles bound with padded leather restraints. A lanky black man in sky blue scrubs stood with his back to us as he made adjustments to a torso restraint. Connor's head swiveled my way, milky eyes fixed on me and tongue lolling. I couldn't control my startle when the PCA turned to face us.
"Angel," he murmured.
"Dude, I'm so glad you're here," I breathed. Kyle Griffin, a former Saberton operative, he was now one of the tribe's best and most loyal combat and infiltration specialists. "Alan, this is Kyle. He's, like me." Alan gave a soft snort.
"No wonder you moved so fast. Good work there."
Kyle inclined his head in acknowledgement.
"The nurse was fortunate I was here."
I peered at his name badge. It looked totally real with Kyle's name and picture. "Connor hasn't gotten his teeth on anyone, right?"
"Not since he arrived," Kyle said in his usual mild tone. "But his presence is an ongoing threat."
Alan's mouth tightened.
"He should be in quarantine. But even that might not be sufficient."
"Maybe we should try brains," I suggested. "See if that helps." Kyle shook his head.
"Already did so at Dr. Nikas's request. Connor won't eat, just bares his teeth or snaps. We're to hold off on any further attempts for now."
I edged closer to the bed. "We need to get him the hell away from the hospital altogether, but I have no idea how we could pull that off." A nurse entered, clipboard in hand.
"Any changes, Kyle?"
"No, ma'am," Kyle said. "Vitals are still depressed. Restraints are holding."
She gave Alan and me a professional, harried smile.
"I'm sorry, but I have to ask you to leave while I..."
"Dr. Renly signed off on my staying per family request,"
Alan said, then casually flashed his badge.
"Also, we're with the coroner's office. I was hoping to have a word with the parish infectious disease doc if he comes down."
Her brows knitted.
I haven't seen Dr. Ingram today, but a doctor from the Louisiana Department of Health and Hospitals met the ambulance as it came in. She and her assistant wanted to get samples processing ASAP. They came in here with Mr. Connor, but must have left right before Kyle came in. Kyle and I exchanged wary glances. How could they have known about Connor in the first place? Alan didn't waver for an instant.
Well, isn't that a crying shame, Miss...
He peered at her name tag.
Patricia. I sure would have liked to speak with her. Do you happen to know what samples they took?
Patricia gestured to the blood draw tube rack on the counter. 4 red tops and a gold, along with an opaque tube they brought with them, saliva, cheek swab, mucus scrapings, and even earwax of all things. I'm not sure what else, but they may still be in the building.
Would you be a lamb and see if you can spot them?
Alan flashed a charming smile. I'd never known Alan was even capable of being charming. Her smile brightened. Sure thing.
You're the best. And if you don't see them, would you mind checking the log for their names? I'd be ever so grateful.
My pleasure, Mr.
Prejean. But please, call me Alan.
She cast a coquettish look over her shoulder and bustled out. What the hell? I said as soon as the door closed.
That was awfully fast for the health department to show up here, Kyle growled.
No, I was talking about Alan turning into some sort of seductive sex god just now. Alan's mouth twitched.
Let's get the samples before she gets back.
He unslung his messenger bag and pulled out a syringe and blood vials.
Kyle can help me. Angel, run interference.
You got it. I leaned against the door. Hard. If that doc wasn't from the health department, I'm betting Alan's paycheck they're from Saberton. And how the hell did they know about Connor?
Same way they knew where and when to go alligator hunting, Kyle said.
A damn bug, I scowled, even with all the sweeps. With Connor gurgling and snapping, Kyle and Alan went to work gathering the needed samples, including earwax, in case Saberton was onto something. As they were finishing up, someone shoved the door.
Out of time, I said in an urgent whisper, holding the door as whoever it was shoved again.
Trusting the guys to scramble, I counted to 5, then pulled the door open. Sorry, dumb place for me to lean. I made a show of step-stumbling back as a stocky, brown-haired man in maroon scrubs entered and gave me a tight smile. Brad Rinley, M.D., according to the name embroidered above the pocket. At least his attention remained on me, which meant the guys weren't in an obviously compromising position. Alan zipped his messenger bag.
Brad, this is the colleague I told you about, Angel Crawford.
Ms. Crawford,
Dr. Rinley said, face relaxing.
A pleasure. I heard you were with Deputy Connor when he went down.
It was pretty awful. Do you know what's wrong? Of course he didn't, but it was the expected question.
We suspect meningoencephalitis, but don't know the cause yet. I'm starting him on broad-spectrum antibiotics. They won't hurt anything if the etiology is viral, but if it's bacterial, better to initiate treatment ASAP. We'll have more answers after a CT scan and a lumbar puncture.
I nodded, anxiety rising. What would a CT scan and lumbar puncture show? From what I'd gathered while working with Dr. Nikas, the zombie parasite couldn't be detected with ordinary medical tests. It required specialized equipment, along with a knowledge of precisely what to look for. But what about the mutated parasite? For all I knew, it might jump up and down and wave at the microscope, yelling, "Hey, look, I'm really fucking weird and like nothing you ever studied in med school." Patricia hurried in, IV bag in one hand and a handwritten note in the other. Dr. Rinley, the EMR system is still down, but Mr. Connor's primary care physician called back. She passed him the note. That's the medical history, no known allergies.
Thanks. Go ahead and hang the paxi.
He glanced at Alan.
Pain in the ass. The entire electronic medical record system crashed hard about 15 minutes ago. Couldn't even get into our backup.
that happen often?
Alan asked.
First time since this system was installed.
He shook his head.
You don't realize how dependent you are until you don't have it.
While Dr. Renly examined the monitor readings, Patricia cautiously approached the bed. Connor let out a howl and lunged, teeth snapping, but the restraints held and Kyle stood ready to intervene. Would she dare get so close if she knew she was dealing with a zombie and not simply an unusual case of meningitis? She hung the IV bag of Paxibiotic alongside a larger bag of normal saline already on the pole, then ran the tubing through the pump. Mr. Prejean? Her tone was cool and professional, probably because Dr. Renly frowned upon staff openly flirting with visitors. The LDHH doctor is Linda Garrison. She was on her way out just now, but she said you can give her a call later.
Ah, okay. I have her number.
Alan glanced my way, forehead creased in puzzlement that echoed my own. Did that mean the people who took the samples really had been from the health department, and not Saberton? I'll be right back, I muttered, and ducked into the corridor. Whatever the deal was with Dr. Garrison, we needed to know for sure. I dug my phone from my pocket as I headed out the ambulance entrance. A black Humvee sat in the physician's parking area barely 20 feet away. A bald man opened the passenger door for a heavyset woman with a long braid of auburn hair. I didn't recognize her, but the man was unmistakable. Baldy, from the Saberton boat. I raised my phone and took a photo. The woman climbed into the vehicle, apparently oblivious to the stupid little sound, but Baldy's gaze snapped my way, eyes narrowing in recognition. Busted. He'd very likely seen my face out in the swamp, plus Saberton security no doubt had my picture plastered up on their most hated list, not that I cared, since he was just as busted. I scratched my nose with my extended middle finger. He closed the passenger door and sauntered around to the driver's side, locked eyes with me, and grabbed his crotch before climbing into the driver's seat and slamming the door. If there hadn't been security cameras, I'd have mooned him. So instead, I settled for a good old Italian chin flick, followed by a full-fisted, up yours. Baldy must have realized he couldn't compete in the obscene gesture game with this white trash chick and pulled out of the parking lot without a comeback. As soon as he drove off, I called Dr. Nikas and filled him in on the Saberton involvement, then sent him the photo. We have to get Connor out of here.
Pierce is looking at options.
He'd better look fast. They're doing a CT scan and lumbar puncture soon.
Oh dear, that is unfortunate.
And Connor is body as hell. The longer he's here, the more chance of someone else getting infected.
I will inform Pierce,
Dr. Nikas said, voice tight and stressed.
Keep me appraised, please.
Wait. Sedatives aren't working on Connor, so that fits the normal zombie model. But they're starting a paxibiotic drip right now. Is that bad?
Antibiotics shouldn't cause a problem. Even with the mutated parasite.
Whew, thank heaven for small favors. I'd better get back in there. Thanks, Dr. N. By the time I reached the room, Patricia and Dr. Renly were gone. Connor still struggled against his restraints, but seemed a touch calmer. Kyle and Alan had their heads together in quiet but intense conversation. Pierce is working on options to get Connor out of here, I told them, but it can't hurt to brainstorm from this end, too.
Removing him from the hospital is one of the options, Kyle said, voice unusually grave. The threat may need to be eliminated.
Right, that's what I just said. I trailed off as his meaning sunk in. You're saying Pierce is thinking of outright killing him?
It's on the table.
Fuck that, not this table. Connor has a mom who loves him. There are a few dozen cops out in the waiting room hoping and praying that he's going to be fine. Pierce can't do that to Connor or to them.
I'm with Angel on this, Alan growled. No one is killing anyone.
Not yet, no, Kyle said. It is a last resort contingency. But Connor is dangerous.
We'll figure out how to make him undangerous, I all but shouted.
We don't even know if he can infect someone else since it's a mutated parasite. Surely Dr. Nikas can learn more from a live subject. We can say he's being transferred to another facility. I shot a desperate look to Alan, but his gaze was on Connor. Kyle released a low sigh. A fictitious transfer to another facility would raise suspicion. His family, friends, and colleagues, cops, wouldn't simply forget about him. There would be a hue and cry over his disappearance, which would engender the sort of attention our kind must avoid. But it could buy us time. Buy him time.
Angel is right, Alan said, expression somber. And even though the Connor we knew may already be gone, I won't condone murder. But if this infection spreads...
He rubbed his eyes.
Maybe it's time to put another option on the table. Turn this over to the CDC.
No, Kyle and I said in unison. Kyle eyed Alan warily, as if assessing whether or not he would take that step on his own. Alan was a solid ally to zombie kind, but we were staring at the kickoff of a potential zombie apocalypse. I couldn't blame him for thinking beyond our need to keep zombies secret. Look, I said, there's no need to get radical with the CDC just yet. Connor turned his milky-eyed gaze on me. A sound rattled deep in his throat before it gurgled out.
Angel.
A chill shuddered through me and settled in my chest. Kyle didn't flinch, but Alan backed away from the bed, eyes wide and pale. It's okay, I forced out, not feeling the least bit okay. Judd did the same thing with his entire cerebrum gone. It doesn't mean anything. Like whether there was a chance Connor was still Connor somewhere in there. Alan's shoulders relaxed a bit, but he stayed well away from the bed. My lower lip began to quiver. Connor wouldn't be in this mess if it wasn't for me. I bit Judd and Angel. Kyle snapped my name out like a whip. Cut the shit. That's like blaming a person who transmits the flu for not keeping their immune system up to snuff. It wasn't the same thing at all, but I couldn't marshal an argument. Fine, I said, voice cracking. To my utter shock, he reached out and pulled me into a hug. I'd never seen Kyle hug anyone, or even give so much as a pat on the back. He was the absolute last person I would have ever described as affectionate or soothing or remotely cuddly. But damn, he had hug superpowers. The tension and anxiety flowed away. It only lasted a few seconds, but when he released me, I felt less as if the world was about to crumble. Thanks, I whispered. Connor moaned long and low, then lay motionless, cloudy eyes fixed on me. I edged closer to the bed. This is the first time he's been still?
Since I've been here, Kyle said.
Alan gestured toward the IV pump.
Might be the antibiotic affecting him.
Dr. Nikas was convinced it wouldn't, I said, but it sure fits the timing. Kyle frowned at the monitor.
His heart rate's dropping.
Before I could ask what that might indicate, Connor wailed in what could only be agony. He went rigid, back arched and hands curled into claws by his sides. Dr. Renly burst in, followed by Patricia. Kyle snapped out a status report as if he'd been born to his PCA role. Renly shouted an order for IV Laura something, but called it off as Connor went limp, head lolling to the side.
Angel.
Connor's voice barely had breath, thin, weak, and scared. A chill swept over me. This was no mindless babble. I'm right here, Connor. His eyes met mine. Milkiness diminished to a mere haze.
Angel.
He let out a long sigh, and his body went so limp it seemed to sink into the mattress.
A systole.
Kyle barked. Dr. Renly cursed. Call a code. Alan rushed out of the room with his messenger bag that contained the covertly obtained samples. Four more staff hurried in, and a flurry of activity commenced under the direction of Dr. Renly.
intubate, compressions, ventilate. I backed into the corner by the door and watched in helpless anguish. For that brief moment, Connor had been himself, and now he was dying. Maybe death was inevitable if the mutated parasite affected a living person. But Connor had seemed so stable earlier, in a shambler sort of way. Earlier, before the antibiotic. If the treatment itself wouldn't hurt the mutated parasite, what was up with the timing? I trusted Dr. Nikas's judgment. I did not trust Saberton. What if Baldy or Dr. Garrison had tainted the bag of paxibiotic? They'd still been in the building when Dr. Renly ordered it. I eased toward the IV pump, where it had been shoved out of the way. Kyle flicked a glance toward me as I reached it, then gave me a micro nod as if gleaning my purpose. Everyone else's attention was fixed on Connor. With a smooth and super casual move, I disconnected the tubing, slipped the bag from the hook, and stuffed it under my shirt. I quietly left the room, arms crossed over my chest to hide the lump, and found Alan by the nurse's station. "Unzip your messenger bag," I murmured, while trying to look worried rather than guilty. He obliged, and I tugged the paxibiotic from beneath my shirt and shoved it in.
"What's that for?"
he asked. "Just a hunch. Might be tainted." I broke off as the sound of activity from Connor's room ebbed away. Dr. Renly's voice carried clearly.
"Time of death."
Numbness crept over my face and hands. No, this wasn't happening. This wasn't right. "I need to make a call," I gasped, and lurched off down the corridor without waiting for a response. The cops were still in the waiting room. Feeling like a coward, I exited through the ambulance doorway. I didn't want to be around when they got the word that Connor had died. Couldn't. I leaned against the wall, cool brick mildly soothing against my back, stared at my phone.
"Angel?"
Dr. Nikas's voice. I must have called him. I swallowed past the knot in my throat and lifted the phone to my ear. "Connor died. I think the Saberton people might have poisoned him with something in the antibiotic. That's when he started going downhill." I took a shuddering breath. "Connor was there, Dr. Nikas."
"What do you mean?"
"In the seconds before he died, it was him, or part of him at least. He was scared. He knew me. It sounds stupid, but..."
"Not stupid at all, Angel,"
he said gently.
"We don't have enough information about the mutation to know what's possible."
"Is he going to go dead shambly now, like Judd and Douglas Horton?"
"Kyle is taking post-mortem samples. I won't know until I can check them for parasite activity."
I rubbed my eyes, and my fingers came away wet. "Okay. You'll keep me in the loop, please?"
"Of course I will, Angel. You can count on me."
I lowered the phone. The doors swooshed open, and Alan exited. He put a hand on my shoulder.
"Angel, I was going to have Nick take care of transporting Connor to the morgue, but I need to send him on a call. I'm sorry."
"It's okay," I said. I want to be the one to bring him in." He gave my shoulder a squeeze.
"I told Nick to meet you at the boat launch to swap vehicles. It's going to be a while before Connor's body is released to us, so I'll text you when you need to come back."
I gave him a grateful nod, then returned to Nick's car and made my escape. The boat launch wasn't exactly a halfway point between morgue and hospital, but I suspected Alan knew I liked it out there. I parked facing the river, then sat on the hood. Sunset cast shimmering streaks of pink and orange across the water. Soon this day would be over. Hard to believe it had started at 4 a.m. No wonder I was exhausted and hungry, in more ways than one, especially since I'd left my bag of brain chips in the van. I could use a burger with a side of brains right now. Nick pulled up a couple of minutes later. I hopped off the Hyundai. He climbed out of the van, sympathy in his eyes.
"I'm so sorry, Angel."
He hesitated, then wrapped his arms around me. I returned the embrace, ready to open up, share the grief with him. The scent of his warm, fresh brain made my mouth water. A shudder went through me and I pulled away. I was a monster. No changing that. I wasn't hungry enough to crack his skull open, but it might happen someday. Nick gave me a puzzled look.
Angel? Sorry. I didn't mean to.
It's not you. I promise. Keys are in the console. I took a step back, safer for both of us if I kept my distance in every way that mattered. Nick gave a single nod, eyes on mine, then tilted his head toward the van.
Okay.
Ditto. For an instant, he looked uncertain, as if he wanted to say more, do more. But then he turned away and climbed into his car.
Call if you need anything.
He hesitated again, then shook his head and drove off.
Fuck,
I said, then said it a few more times. I grabbed the bag of brain chips and stuffed four in my mouth, which kept me from continuing to say fuck until the heat death of the universe. The van didn't have a hood I could sit on, so I leaned against the bumper and finished the chips while the sun slipped below the horizon. I tried to think of anything but Connor. Biology notes, the morgue inventory, the fate of the frogs. But the mental image of his eyes floated before me, and his voice endlessly whispered, Angel? My phone rang as the first stars made their appearance. Dr. Nikas.
Kyle arrived with the samples, he said. I've only performed the test for parasite activity on the post-mortem sample thus far, but I wanted you to know that it is negative. Deputy Connor is truly deceased.
Oh, I swallowed.